Welcome to Sacrilegious Discourse.
For this is what the Sovereign Lord says.
Why do you need prophets to tell people who you are and what you want?
If you can justify everything that the God of the Bible has done, then you can justify any of your behavior.
A lot of this mentality is trickling into what is now mainstream right-wing Christianity.
I am capable of empathy greater than this God of the Bible.
This is a Bible that they tell kids. This is the good Lord. This is the good book. He is fantasizing about murder, mass murder.
Head over to sacrilegiousdiscourse.com right now to find out how to leave us a review or support us on Patreon.
Husband!
Wife!
Do you know what we're doing today?
Well, we read two chapters.
Sure as fuck did.
We said, so we're doing not regular. We're doing a
Q&A, not on Saturday,
right?
But it's a big one.
Apparently, you said this is going to be a long one.
Yeah. This is covering chapters 17 and 18 of Little Maddie.
Okay.
And I don't know if you remember what happened in 17, but Jesus transfigured or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
He was.
There was a lot of shit happened.
He was a robot in disguise.
There was a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So we got some shit to unpack here.
And it's probably going to be fun. I'm sure.
It's going to be annoying as fuck.
All right. You ready to do this?
Sure as fuck am.
All right. Let's do it.
Okie dokie. All right. So in Little Maddie, chapter 17.
Yeah.
Jesus transfigures, and he talks about triumph and taxes and shit like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Chapter 17 is basically like a miniature summary of Matthew's entire agenda. And you better believe he is coming into this with a fucking agenda.
Oh, I believe.
I don't
believe that. That I do believe.
If you didn't believe that before chapter 17, chapter 17 seals the deal. Okay, We get Jesus here is greater than Moses. He's the fulfillment of the capital L law. He's the fulfillment of the prophets. He's endorsed by God because God's like, this is my son. He possesses miraculous power. He's misunderstood by all of his followers. And he heads towards death and resurrection, like straight like an arrow. He just marches right toward it.
And it was witnessed by all of three people.
Yes. Yes.
So we can't, interview.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or give a polygraph test too.
But Matthew.
Not that those are accurate.
Matthew stacks like every single Jesus-ish related thing in this one chapter. Like if it's related to Jesus, it gets stuffed into chapter 17.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a mess. This fucking chapter was a mess. It was like a nightmare. But
yeah.
I'm still in awe that there was basically like a tea party, a Mad Hatter's tea party where they all sat down at a table together and were just like passing tea and crumpets with the dormouse.
Right.
And then Moses and fucking Elijah just appear out of nowhere. Like my mind is still trying to grasp that they really did do that.
No, when they started rattling off who was there, I'm like, what the fuck is happening?
I was like, no, I'm done. I'm out.
This is not okay.
Nope, I'm out. So I don't know if we've really understood this as much as we should have, but Matthew has been comparing Jesus to Moses for several chapters now, like in a really hardcore way.
Okay.
Because he's really trying to sane wash, like Old Testament wash.
Yeah.
This new stuff. He really wants to show that, no, it's valid. It's totally valid. Okay.
But the problem is that it's not.
Right. And that's why he has to try so hard.
Right.
Okay. He wouldn't have to try so hard.
If it matched.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
So he's got to make shit up.
Right.
So we're supposed to understand, based on what we've read so far, that both Jesus and Moses survive a murderous king. They both left somewhere, like Moses leaves Egypt, whereas Jesus comes out of Egypt.
Okay.
They both go up on a mountain. to do their preachy doodles.
Jesus went up quite a bit. Well, actually, you know, Moses went up twice.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. No, three times because he went up there to die. Well,
Jesus went up to receive revelation. Jesus went up and gave revelation.
Got it.
Okay, so that's a cute comparison.
Yeah.
Okay, and both of their faces shine.
Huh.
Yeah.
I don't recall Moses' face shining, but I'm sure it must
did.
Be in there.
It did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. So, you know, because in the glory of God's presence,
sure.
their face gets shiny.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's been happening. And we're supposed to pick up on, oh my God, Jesus is the new Moses. And
I see.
You know how much Jewish people love Moses?
Yeah.
So they should really love Jesus.
Right.
Because he's like Moses times 10.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Matthew's basically screaming that out loud. Jesus is the new Moses.
Okay.
And we're supposed to just run with that. Okay.
I feel like the case is a little weak.
Well, it is.
Overall.
It is. You know,
like,
it is. What's really funny is that Moses appears in this scene to lend validity to Jesus and then ends up becoming secondary.
Was that lending validity?
Yeah.
Because I thought it was just absurd.
It was absurd. But like,
this whole thing is absurd.
No, totally, totally. But his presence there is supposed to like comfort us and make us feel like, ah, Moses is in on this, so it must be true? Question mark.
Okay.
But again, he shows up just to become secondary to somebody
Jesus,
else.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Matthew elevates Jesus above the two greatest figures in Jewish history.
Yeah.
Which is so fucking insulting. And that would have been a massive claim.
Yeah.
So again, I'm like, Jesus did not tiptoe.
Well, and it's like they've completely forgot the calling John the Baptist, the Elijah, you know, reborn type.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like,
oh, yeah.
Why is Elijah there, but also he was John the Baptist?
Because, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
So, but before we get to the Elijah is John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to talk about the transformation of Jesus.
Okay.
Before his two disciples.
Three.
Yeah, yeah. You're right.
The two brothers and
Simon called Peter
the,
and James
guy.
And
somebody else.
So the word transfigure comes from the Greek metamorpho.
Right.
Okay. It's literally where we get the word metamorphosis.
Right.
I gather that.
Yeah.
And it means to be transformed in appearance.
Sure.
Kind of like the metamorphosis where my guy changes into a cockroach.
Right.
Have you ever read that story? It's insane.
I actually haven't, but I know
so
of it. It's
so good. It's so weird and crazy.
Yeah.
He just wakes up one day and he's like, yo, I'm a cockroach. What?
Right.
Yeah.
When I think of transforming, I think of like Optimus Prime.
I mean, that's why I keep doing those noises. Because, yeah. So Matthew says that Jesus's face shines like the sun and his clothes become dazzling white. And to a first century Jewish audience, this would sound like this person is revealing their divine nature. Okay.
Okay.
Like that's what they would have understood that to mean.
They got the good bleach.
Yeah. Basically. But Matthew is like, when he's writing this story, he's like using shorthand. Okay.
Sure.
Kind of like how if you're watching a movie and you see a lot of red imagery,
mm-hmm.
that is shorthand for, okay, there's going to be a lot of death and stuff in this, in this story.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So this is shorthand. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's also the same kind of imagery that was used for Moses after Mount Sinai. And heavenly beings in apocalyptic literature also use this when writers were writing this shit down.
Yeah.
And divine manifestations throughout Jewish tradition leaned heavily on these shorthands.
Okay.
It's symbolism that was accepted to the audience to mean certain things.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why the shining face and the bright white.
Okay.
Like, okay, so we know that this is holy. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So we had a question. Why was it only Peter, James, and John? John was the guy. I couldn't remember him.
Right.
Because
there's another John.
Because after John the Baptist, what other John could there
be? That's right, yeah.
There's only one John.
Yeah.
There was Big John, and then there was nobody.
Get out of here with your multiple Johns.
Right? So we were like, why those three? And I told you when we read chapter 18, we were recapping chapter 17. And this came up. And I said, actually, we will find out this trio shows up a lot. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And, that's, you did mention that.
Yeah. And yeah. You were like, oh, right. Okay. So these were his boys. Like there was Tucci Gang and then there was the insiders of Tucci Gang.
Right. Cause you need someone to spread your lies for you.
Right. So. Exactly. Exactly. So there's a story in Mark that we'll get to that Matthew doesn't cover, but Mark does, that he's going to raise somebody's daughter. And those three are the only ones there to see it.
Of course.
The transfiguration we saw, the thing where they arrived in Gethsemane, that city.
Yeah.
And that whole thing that happened. So these three are always present during these big moments. Events. Yeah.
Right.
These are his boys. They're basically Jesus's inner circle. And our question was, okay, so but why them? Like, what's up with them? And nobody really knows, but there's some common theories. They were his most trusted disciples, which that goes to figure.
Sure.
They were his future leaders, which, I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand.
Right.
They were simply his closest friends, which, again, that would mean that they were his most trusted, which is why they were the future leaders. These sure. are all just, like, all circling around the same thing.
Right, right.
Another thing is that the story did originate from traditions associated with these three. So
okay.
these three would have been the ones.
It just seems very convenient that we're supposed to base an entire fucking religion on some texts that were written well after Jesus died. And that apparently three people witnessed that didn't right. actually write anything themselves.
Right.
And I mean, there's just so many like this is what. This massive religion, this is what this is based on 2,000 fucking years plus ago.
Look, it was already silly, but then chapter 17 just was like, sorry to be grotesque, but the nail, the nail in the wrist, you know? Chapter 17 was like, oh no, I can't even, nope, it's too silly, I'm sorry. No,
and then it is, like, they were reading through this and it's silly.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm kind of blown away about how silly it is.
Right.
Because I was expecting more.
I was expecting more beauty and spirituality. And what I got was a clown show.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay.
Like, how do people not see through? Like, I know we're going to get a lot of our fans that are going to write to us and say, well, I saw through it. And that's fair. Mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of people break away from Christianity, because they take the time to be.
They read chapter 17 straight through.
Of the words that are actually written in the fucking Bible. Yeah. Right. But how has this survived? Fucking critical thought towards these stories. And we talk about this with such reverence, right?
Yeah.
Like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? Like these are the four gospels of the Bible. And you always hear reverence attached to those things. Mm-hmm. And we're reading this first one and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
where the fuck are you getting reverence from this?
I don't know, because I don't have it. Right. I don't feel it.
I can see if you pick out a goddamn sentence, mm-hmm. but like if you read it in full in context,
it's silly. It's just silly. It's absurd and nonsensical, and it's goofy. You can't
convince me otherwise.
No, it's just goofy. So here's the thing, as you pointed out, as for Matthew, he wasn't one of the guys. He wasn't there.
Right.
He wrote this, or his followers did, or whatever.
Yeah.
So where did he get the story from? Mm. It's not likely that Matthew was like sitting in the background taking notes. So the traditional answer to this is that Peter, James, or John later told everybody, including Matthew, what happened.
Except that they weren't supposed to tell anybody.
Right.
According to Jesus.
So they didn't really obey him.
Right.
Oopsie.
Yeah.
The scholarly answer is that Matthew was probably using earlier traditions, which we know he leaned heavily on. The book of Mark came before him.
Okay.
So we know that he basically copied a lot of that shit.
Sure.
Especially the Gospel of Mark. Ha, huh? See? I was right. I actually said that from memory before I read my next line in my notes.
Yeah.
So good on me. I did learn a thing. And Mark already contained a lot of these stories.
Okay.
So that's why. That's how.
Okay.
That's how Matthew did it. We'll talk more about where Mark got the story when we get to Mark.
Sure.
Okay. And I will ask that question repeatedly. Where did these guys get this fucking story from?
Look, we haven't got to the other books yet, but I feel like the fact that there are four Gospels mm-hmm. about essentially the same story, mm-hmm. they're going to be different in some ways.
Slightly.
But the fact that there are four Gospels to start the New Testament mm-hmm. is just, it's like they're trying way too fucking hard to say, no, it really is real. This is real. Like four times it's real.
Okay, listen, I don't mind that. I really don't. I don't mind a bunch of people stepping forward and giving their witness testimony of what they heard and what they saw.
If they were actually witness testimonies.
No, yeah, but like that part doesn't bug me, honestly. Okay. I like that there is more than one person, more than one gospel.
Sure.
It would bother me if there was only one, because I'd be like, why the fuck should I believe you? Nobody else talked about this.
Right.
Whereas there's four. Okay. There's four people. None of you were there, but okay.
Right. And we're going to find out, obviously, you kind of already touched on it, that mm-hmm. a lot of these lean heavily on the other books.
Right.
Like they kind of bounce off of each other somewhat.
Circular logic. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know where Mark got his. We're not there yet.
No. I got you. I'm just saying that there is some circular logic within this bullshit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So then we get Moses and Elijah fucking appear out of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. They show up to the tea party at the Mad Hatter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is where things get really fucking weird.
Because they weren't already.
Moses and Elijah, they're not just random cameos, though. Like, they were specifically chosen to be the cameos.
Got it.
Okay. Moses is there to represent the capital L law. And Elijah is there to represent the prophets.
Mm.
Okay?
Okay.
So between the two of them, they symbolize the entirety of Jewish scripture.
Wow.
So that the message becomes everything in Judaism was always pointing toward Jesus.
Okay.
These are the two biggest guys. They represent everything in Judaism up to now. And they are telling us, go team Jesus. And so the Christians can then just pick up the baton and say, we did it. We're here now. we're the new religion now.
Okay.
And they did.
Yeah.
And I hate it.
Right.
Okay.
No, this is bad.
And Matthew loves this kind of symbolism. So he does this a lot.
Sure.
How did the disciples even recognize Moses and Elijah, right?
That's like a great question.
They weren't wearing name tags.
Right.
Right? Or were they? I don't know.
I don't know either.
And nobody says how they
were
recognized.
To imagine that it was like a boxing match and they like, and in this corner, we...
or like, prum, prum, prum. Yes, hello, my name is Moses. Nice to meet you. Yes. And they all shake hands, you know.
Right.
I'm very, very pleased to meet you.
Right.
Yes. What was your name again? Oh, I'm Elijah. No, the whole thing is so silly.
It is.
Okay. Moses had been dead for over 1,000 years. And so this is just one of those little details that we just like wave our hands at and go,
sure.
Oh.
Yeah.
So if this was actually written as a story today, the editor would send it right back and say, rewrite.
Oh, fuck yeah. The whole goddamn book.
Yeah. This ain't working.
Look, we touched on this too. Like, this is better written than a lot of the Old Testament. But it's still bad.
It's so bad. It's so silly. I know I keep leaning on that word. It's my crutch, but I can't help it if it's true.
Right.
All right. So then Peter equates Jesus with Moses and Elijah and is dramatically rebuked by a voice from the cloud of God's glory. Okay.
Okay.
So, because he's like, whoa, Jesus is like Moses and Elijah. This is awesome.
Sure.
So this is another example of one of Peter's recurring character traits. Remember, this is Simon called Peter, called Satan, called Rocky.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about how we're going to see him repeatedly be an impetuous goofball. Like he speaks first and he, you know, stepped onto the water and he only floated for a minute before he drowned.
Right. He's got to do all the blunders.
Yeah. He's the dum-dum.
Right.
He's the comic relief.
Sure.
Okay. He constantly talks before thinking. He immediately wants to build three shrines. Remember, he was like, oh, we're all here. I'll build all the tents for all you guys.
Right, right.
And I was like, oh, Moses and Elijah spending the night and get a tent, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Most translations say, let me put up three shelters. But the word can mean tent, booth, or tabernacle. I believe the one we read said tent. not shrine.
Right.
But it could have been shrine.
Got
okay?
it.
So this may have been a reference. A lot of scholars put forth that this may have been a reference to one of the Jewish festivals that would have fallen during that time. Sukkot. I'm not sure.
Sure.
How to pronounce it. I apologize. Okay. It's one that we still celebrate today, though.
Got it.
Where temporary shelters would have been built to commemorate the Exodus.
Right.
And Peter seems like he might be trying to turn the event into a religious festival. Oh. So God immediately interrupts him and shuts that shit down. Like, I don't know if you recall, God was like, no.
We're so done with festivals all over the place.
Like,
you guys.
Peter's have too so many. Excited, right? He's like, yo, Moses and Elijah, what up? Yeah, I'm about to get real. And then God is like, no.
Right.
So Matthew consistently portrays Peter as both devoted and impulsive. He's just a silly child.
He does everything wrong.
We're supposed to go, oh, Peter.
Right.
Or, oh, this guy, huh? You know Peter. So the transfiguration scene contains perhaps the ultimate example as God literally cuts him off mid-sentence.
Right.
Like, we're not doing a party.
Yeah.
And, you know, Peter was like, party in the mountain tonight. Yeah. The mountain scene characters include Jesus, Moses, Elijah, and God's voice, as well as a cloud.
Okay? Right.
It was cloudy that day.
Sure.
And this is Matthew pulling out every theological stop to create the ultimate crossover event, which I mentioned at the time. I was like, what even is happening?
Yeah.
And we did not expect this cameo.
No, this hit me out of nowhere. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was not at all expecting this.
I was like, wait, does everybody's Bible have this? Or just, is this a goof? You're goofing.
I didn't know that this happened.
Give me the real one. Come on.
This is not one of those things that they tell you when you're not a Christian.
Right.
They don't tell that all these people met up on a mountain.
No, they do not.
I've never heard that story before.
Mm-mm, me neither.
So.
That's because it's silly. So the disciples react with a holy fear, okay?
Yeah.
Throughout the Hebrew Bible, meeting God was potentially fatal.
Well, yeah.
So the standard reaction is naturally, what do? You fall down on your fucking face.
Absolutely. Right?
You panic. You assume death is imminent.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did.
Because he was a dick.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. I mean, how many times did we say God is a dick?
Right.
Yahweh's a dick. He's a dick.
Right.
So yeah, they immediately, they're like, oh, fuck me. And Peter was like, talking about party, and God's like, no. And so they immediately fall on their faces and they're terrified.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay?
Okay.
Because here's the problem of Elijah coming first. Jesus had said, or the Old Testament had said, somebody's going to clear the way for Jesus.
Yeah.
Right? So our question was, wait, so John the Baptist is like Elijah reincarnated?
Right.
What is happening there? We
touched on that earlier in Matthew, right?
So, right. But it's not reincarnation.
Okay.
Okay.
What the fuck is it?
It's not mainstream Christian interpretation of reincarnation anyway.
Okay, look.
Is reincarnation not?
What?
What?
Either he's John the Baptist or he's Elijah.
No.
There is no fucking.
He's the spiritual idea of.
Oh my God.
No. This idea comes from the prophecy in the book of Malachi. That's, you know, what said somebody will come before the new Messiah.
Yeah.
So people expected Elijah to return before the Messiah. The Messiah's here. Jesus is like, yo, that's me. So I guess John the Baptist must have been the Elijah.
John,
guy.
You're up.
Yep.
You're
yep.
Elijah now.
Sure. So Jesus said John came in the spirit and power of Elijah.
Okay.
Okay. Same mission, same prophetic role, same style. Not literally Elijah being reborn.
Okay.
And apparently we're just supposed to hold on to our butts because Luke is going to explain it to us better.
I'm sure.
And I'm like, okay, yeah. Okay, I'll wait with bated breath to see how Luke does. Because Matthew did a piss poor job.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Matthew. Right?
Especially when Elijah shows up in the same goddamn book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like, what?
No, it's silly.
Yeah.
Okay, so verse 9 reads, as they were coming down the mountain, Remember?
Yeah, right.
Seeing it? Yeah. Yeah. Jesus instructed them, don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead.
Right.
Right? Many translations read, tell no one about the vision that you've seen. And this raises a very interesting point to ponder. Because a lot of Christians are like, no, everything in the Bible happened is totally true, and I believe it, right? Mm-hmm. But many modern scholars think that Matthew accidentally gives readers permission to read this event less literally than Christians often do.
Well, yeah.
Because a vision would mean that Moses and Elijah weren't, like, actually physically present.
Sure.
Because, duh.
They went up there and did some drugs, and,
yes.
They had visions.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah.
We smoked something and we saw some shit. So anyways, Jesus is like, don't tell anybody.
Right.
But also Jesus, at the same time, he's performing miracles in front of thousands of witnesses. Crowds are following him around. Entire towns know who this fool is. So he's like, don't tell anyone. Wink, wink, wink. Right? The secret is astonishingly ineffective. It's right. Like the best kept not secret.
Amongst all the other, like, he's literally said that so many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it's absurd.
Well, we called it out, right? But here's the thing. There's actually a term for that. So we were onto something, which, again, I just love when we are dum-dums. We are neither scholars nor academics. So it's always amazing to me when we, like, pick up on something
yeah.
that scholars are like, oh, no, actually, that is a good question. And we ask that as well.
Right.
This concept is referred to as the messianic secret. It's a thing that is argued about. He kept saying, don't tell, and yet at the same
right.
time.
Yeah.
So there's a few theories, okay? One theory is that the early church needed to explain why Jesus wasn't universally recognized as Messiah during his lifetime.
Right.
So stories developed where Jesus intentionally kept it a secret, okay?
Right.
So they, like, backfilled him saying, shh, don't tell anybody.
That was kind of my theory.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I was like, yeah, this sounds like a way to make sure that it didn't matter that he wasn't overly popular.
Right. Well, there's another theory that also kind of fits as well.
Okay.
And I lean maybe towards this one. Jesus wanted to avoid premature political expectations. So he might have not been saying, shh, don't tell anybody, so much as he was saying, y'all, the working class, keep it on the down low. Don't tell the union leaders. Don't tell the politicians. Don't tell the you know, big wigs. Don't let them, everybody, you know, chill, right? Keep it on the down low.
I guess.
There's yet another theory, though. Matthew inherited the tradition and repeated it because it served his theological purposes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one, right? Yeah.
Right.
And it could have been a mix of all three, honestly.
Sure.
Like, a lot of backfilling, and it was convenient, and also the secret was amongst the working class, and they were trying to keep it from the town leaders.
But just the amount of questions just on this one thing.
Yeah.
Just lends so little credibility to the whole story.
Right, because the whole towns were following him. Like, you don't think that the leaders of the town would notice, Shay, where's everybody in town going today? Huh. I noticed that the square is rather empty and all the stores are closed.
Right.
Huh. Beats me.
But I mean, the amount of questions that we've had since we started the New Testament mm-hmm. is just immense.
Immense.
And
no answers.
And a lot of them are valid questions, you know,
yeah.
like, and no one talks about this.
There's a lot of questions and there's not a lot of answers.
Right.
And scholars are like, yeah, that is a good question. And
right.
we will get that a lot throughout the New Testament, is being pat on the head and told, you're right. That is a good question.
Right. And
with no answer.
The answers that you get from a pastor are, it's not ours to question.
And I'm like, no, it's exactly a scholar's
question.
Right.
Like, how the fuck can we not?
Right. You tell me a story not as silly. Okay, you bring me something different. This story is silly.
Right. No, but here's the thing. There are so many denominations of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, amongst your ranks, you mm-hmm. guys question mm-hmm. the differences in the text.
Yeah.
Right? That is a thing. That's why there are multiple denominations.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it okay for you guys to question it and break away as a church.
Right.
But it's not okay for you to be resolved in your ideas of what you stand for and answer those same questions for your parishioners.
Yeah. Or the rest of us. The rest of us would like to know as well.
That makes no fucking sense.
You're not selling me. You're not making me believe. You're not convincing me. Like,
right.
I'm sorry, your story is silly.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I'm doomed to hell because you couldn't tell a better story.
Right.
That kind of sucks, honestly.
Yeah.
So, okay. They get down to the bottom of the hill, the mountain, whatever.
Yeah.
And Jesus casts out a very difficult demon. There's an unclean spirit inside this boy.
Right.
Okay. And the demon was too tough for the disciples to handle.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember this. Yeah.
So the epilepsy story reveals an ancient medical worldview. The Greek word often translated here is literally moonstruck.
Okay.
Ancient people often associated seizures with lunar interference, and that's where we get the word lunacy. It survived into the English to this day.
Okay.
Yeah, because luna means moon.
Right.
So, which I knew that lunatic came from like lunar activity and believing that people were acting more insane during certain phases of the moon.
Sure.
Like I understood that, but I didn't know that this went back as far as
the Bible.
People with epilepsy in the Bible were considered lunatics.
Right.
Like what?
Yeah.
So the story preserves traces of ancient folk medicine, which is kind of interesting.
Okay.
Anyways, whatever. So Jesus easily casts the demon out, and that's cool, right?
Sure.
But then the guys were like, why couldn't we heal him, right?
Because you guys suck.
And then he's like, oh, you of little faith, right? And we were like, wait, what? That doesn't make sense. Because the text says that the disciples failed to heal him because of little faith, but they clearly expected whatever they were doing to work. So they had faith, right? And we talked about that in the moment. Like, no, they had faith. They'd been doing this work, right?
Right.
So why couldn't they do it this time? Yeah. It wasn't a lack of faith. So what's going on here?
Right.
If they didn't have faith, they wouldn't have tried.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, who knows? I don't know.
Whatever.
But anyway, yeah. But
this is something that we were like, that doesn't make any sense.
Right, yeah.
Like, the work didn't fail until the lack of faith didn't come until after the work failed.
Right.
Like, what's happening? So there's various explanations, of course. So, okay, here's the traditional explanation. They were trusting in themselves instead of God.
Oh.
And now that's just written in, and I don't know where traditionalists get that idea.
Well, they needed an answer, so they made one up.
They made one up.
Yeah.
Right. The literary explanation is that Matthew's using this. He wants to teach a lesson about faith, so he uses their failure as an example. And
I feel like that's more in line with...
He just didn't think the story all the way through.
Right.
And it's stupid.
Sure.
It's silly,
I think that's
as usual.
Very in line with how this book of Matthew is written.
And that leads to what the skeptical explanation is, which leans into that.
Right.
The explanation is added after the fact. The miracle failed, so the narrative supplies a theological reason for it to have done so.
And we're assuming that there was even a miracle at all.
Right.
I doubt even that.
So right, exactly.
The story was introduced for reasons of the story.
Look how awesome Jesus is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then out of the blue, Jesus is like, oh, by the way, don't forget that I told you that story about how I'm going to die and whatever.
Yeah.
And anyways, it's time to pay the temple tax. Cool, cool, cool. Right? So during that time, he called Peter Simon.
Yeah.
And that was weird to us.
It was.
And we were like, there's surely significance there.
Right.
Well, apparently there's not.
Oh.
There's no significance whatsoever.
So we just switched up what we're calling him that day.
Jesus switches between them, his names, throughout the Gospels.
Why?
Because.
That's okay.
Some interpreters think that using Simon creates a more personal tone here specifically, but that doesn't seem to be any particular significance attached to Jesus's usage of Simon's birth name as opposed to his nickname.
Okay. So
he did it because.
I see.
Yeah. That, and we're just supposed to go with it.
Okay. Yeah. I don't like that answer.
I don't like it either. I don't. Yeah. I was like, oh, there's no reason. He's just. The story just did that.
Right.
For no reason. Yeah. That feels weird.
Yeah.
Like everything in the Bible is supposed to have significance. And then this felt significant,
and
it
wasn't.
It's a big nothing burger. Yeah.
Okay.
But things that are not significant are.
Right.
It's just so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So then there's that whole tax thing, right? And Jesus pays the tax anyway by miraculous provision.
Yeah.
And this section's like really fucking weird.
It is.
Okay. The tax supported the temple in Jerusalem. So Jesus asks Peter, do kings tax their own strangers? Or I'm sorry, do kings tax their own children or strangers? And Peter answers, strangers,
right.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And Jesus concludes, oh, well, then the sons go free. You know, kids sure. under 12 eat free, right?
Right.
So I don't have to pay.
Yeah.
Meaning, if God is a king, I'm God's son, so I don't owe the temple tax because right. I'm a son.
Right. Very convenient.
Right? So Jesus is basically claiming he's exempt, but then he immediately decides to pay anyways.
Sure.
He's like, I don't technically owe it, but I'm not going to die on this hill.
Right.
I am going to like make sure to tell you about it so that you write it down.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The miracle with the coin in the fish's mouth,
remember, yeah.
to pay that tax,
right.
it was like an odd amount, and the coin was the exact amount that was owed.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, this story is unique to Matthew. None of the other Gospels have it.
Hmm.
But let us keep in mind that Matthew was a tax collector.
Right.
A lot of his stories will have to do with money and debt.
Sure.
Okay, and we will revisit this in chapter 18.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
So, there's chapter 17 done.
Got
okay?
it. Yeah.
All right, so we move on to chapter 18. Okay?
Okay.
And chapter 18 is less about miracles and more about community.
All right.
You get lots of community stories. Humility, children, lost people, conflict, authority, forgiveness.
Yeah.
Okay? It's basically Jesus answering the question, how are these people all supposed to live together? Which is a lot of what the Old Testament was about, right? In the early, like the Pentateuch was
yeah.
answering that question. And so the law, right?
Right.
And Jesus is like, I'm going to break down the law
right.
a little bit better for you.
Right.
And it's like, oh, are you?
Yeah.
The fuck?
Right.
Do you think you is, sir?
Well, I mean, obviously he thinks he's the son of God.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
At least according to him.
It's just, I would have been so annoyed. I could tell you right now which team I would have been on, and it wouldn't have been his.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He has no footing here.
Right.
He's very bad. He's being very bad. He's being a very bad Jew. I'm sorry. He is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this Jesus guy.
I'm not
in
either.
This book.
No.
Another thing, though, is that Jesus continues to use the word church
yeah.
throughout here. You pointed that out again.
Right.
Yeah. This is one of the clearest signs that Matthew is writing for an organized movement rather than merely just recording memories.
Yeah.
He is hardcore pushing theology here.
Which I said at the time does
yep.
not bode well for the story to hold water.
Yeah.
Because that tells me that you're writing this with an intent behind it.
You have an agenda, my good sir.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, when you write with an agenda like that, that's so curled into everything, like it makes it very difficult to separate what can be reliable. You're not a reliable source at all.
Well, and more than that, they literally put the word church into Jesus's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
In the red letters.
Right? Yeah.
So
Jesus did not speak that word.
Right. And that alone almost gives you zero confidence in this writing.
Exactly.
And so to me, it spoils the whole fucking, like, of other things that spoiled the whole fucking story,
it invalidates his words.
That also does that in a very large way. Like,
oh, so this isn't the words of God. Got it. Okay, yeah. Okay.
It's the words of God that you have interpreted for us and decided that we needed to hear.
Yeah. Who knows what Jesus actually said?
He might have said
nothing.
But
it wasn't this.
He might have said nothing.
Exactly.
It might have sounded nothing like this at all.
Yeah. It wasn't this. I can tell you that much.
At least not verbatim, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so we start off chapter 18 with the disciples asking, who's the greatest in the kingdom? And we were like, what the fuck? Like, it was so weird. It was such a weird start.
It was.
Okay, so what's happening here is the disciples are asking about rank. Okay, they likely wish to know whom Jesus was going to make his prime minister, whom his general, his chief chancellor, supreme judge, etc.
Yeah.
Which I didn't understand that was the case, but that's what's happening.
Okay.
Okay. And they also were asking what measure the decision would be made by. Is it going to be made by who first became Jesus's disciple, who's his nearest relative, who he visits with or entertains most frequently, who's the oldest? That's what they're asking.
Okay.
They want to know about the hierarchy.
Right.
Not asking, how do we help people? How do we become more compassionate? How do we make the world better? They want to know who is in charge here.
Got it.
We need to understand this organization. We need a flow chart.
Yeah.
And Jesus was like, y'all. So to answer, Jesus sets a child as an example of humility.
Yeah, we didn't like this at all.
No, not at all. But Jesus says that greatness comes through humility, simplicity, and disinterestedness.
Right.
Not status.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, modern readers hear the word child and we think innocence, right?
Sure.
Like, that must be what he meant. And that's what Christians would tell you, that's what that meant.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because that's what child means to us.
Sure.
Okay. But ancient audiences heard the word child and they didn't hear, oh, innocent, sweet, pure, good, right? What they heard was the lowest of low status, no authority, no political power, extreme dependence on everyone around them.
Got it.
It was all about the lowest of the low. So sure. He's saying, y'all want to know who's in charge? Somebody like this, the lowest of the low.
Got it.
Which that makes it make a little bit more sense of why he would say child. Not like, Jesus loves the little children. Like, it's not that. That's not what he's saying at all. Fuck the children. Like, honestly, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, like, even these fuck faces down at the bottom. Lowly worms, as Yahweh used to call people, right? Yeah.
Right.
Even these fuck faces at the bottom, they are what leadership looks like.
Okay.
Okay. And I kind of like that, if I'm being honest. And I also like that, Christians got it wrong. They have no idea what the fuck they're talking about. And they're going around singing about Jesus loving children. Well, and it's
I'm going to push back on that just a little bit, because with regard to whether they got it wrong or not is like, this whole thing is so convoluted.
No, totally.
Everyone's wrong.
No, totally.
So everyone's right.
No, but I'm
so just, everyone's all.
You know. I'm just enjoying this moment where I can specifically look at somebody singing that song at me and being like, that's not what Jesus meant.
Right.
Because that one I'll remember. I won't remember a lot of this shit. Like, I don't remember stuff from we read from the Old Testament like 5 years ago when we started this. Five and a half years. Almost 6 years ago.
Yeah.
When we started this project.
Yeah.
I won't remember a lot of it, but I will remember that he meant children are worms, not children are sweet, innocent babes.
Sure.
That one is funny to me.
Right.
So in this instance, Jesus is overturning status hierarchies. Okay. Children were not romanticized back then the way we romanticize them today. Like, who will save the children? Who will speak for the trees and the children? Ladies and children first.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Today, children are often viewed as precious, pure, and special. But ancient societies viewed children a lot more pragmatically because of high infant mortality rates.
Sure.
Limited legal rights and low social standing. They would have seen them as worms, like I said.
Got it.
So Jesus using a child as a model of greatness would have sounded so much more radical. And I'm here for it. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this Jesus guy, but I am a fan of that.
Sure.
So, okay. So we get verse 6. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So we're going to cover two points in that: little ones and the millstone.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Little ones used here may not actually mean children when he says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble. He might not actually be talking about children.
Okay.
When Jesus warns against causing little ones to stumble, a lot of churches do interpret this as protecting children. You know, Jesus loves the little children.
Right.
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 But throughout Matthew's gospel, when he refers to little ones, he often means ordinary believers, vulnerable followers, and people with little power.
So it could mean children, but also
it's the people who are as powerless and at the bottom as children.
Got it.
Okay. Not children themselves.
Right.
But the people who are worms like children.
Sure.
So the warning is a lot broader along the lines of don't exploit vulnerable people.
Yeah.
Don't be a fucker.
Right.
You know? All right. So there's that. Little ones is the lowest of the low, the worms. Now we're going to talk about the millstone. So a millstone where he says it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty bad, right?
It does.
Actually even worse than you think it is.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
That's great.
Yeah. So a millstone wasn't just a cute little grinding wheel. In ancient times, before the invention of wind and water mills, the stones were commonly turned by slaves, asses, or mules.
Right.
And those which were donkey powered weighed hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
So in Syria and in Greece, this mode of punishing criminals, drowning them, mm-hmm. was practiced regularly. Mm-hmm. It was just a thing. Yeah. Especially in cases of parricide, which would be murdering your mom or your dad.
Got it.
Okay. When a person was devoted to destruction, for public safety, they would like, go ahead, this guy's a fuck. Let's just drown him.
Okay.
Right? Also, in cases of plague, famine, etc., like, this guy's got the plague. He's going to kill us all. Let's just drown him. Fucking drown his ass. Just tie that shit around his neck. Drown
him. Fuck quarantine.
Yeah. Like, they didn't know.
Right.
They just thought, if he's got the plague, he is demon infested.
Right.
Like, drown him for his own good. And look, what happened, he died, right? He took the plague with him.
Sure.
So it was a drastic form of quarantine that worked and proved their case that it was the right thing to do.
Right, okay.
For all the wrong reasons.
All right.
So when a person was drowned, they hung a weight like a vast stone around the neck.
Yeah.
Similarly, ancient Hindu law stated if a woman causes any person to take poison, sets fire to any person's house, or murders a man, then the magistrate, having bound a stone to her neck, shall drown her.
Mm.
So drowning was just a common law back then.
Okay.
So what Jesus is describing here is an absolutely horrifying execution.
Right.
So he's saying it would be better for these people to fucking drown horribly, horribly, and rather than, you know, to have stumbled.
Yeah.
So fuck you for that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, Jesus, you're rude. All right. So then he warns that offenses are inevitable, but we're to have no part in offending. Okay. And then he also talks about the judgment awaiting those who cause other people to sin. And he's just like going on and on.
Right.
Okay. Like, there was so much read in this chapter. It was so boring.
Yeah.
And very confusing, because he was just like, don't be this, don't do that. And you should run in circles. And
right. They're trying to bring their own law.
Yeah. Yeah.
Capital L.
Capital L law. Yeah. Right. It was so offensive to me, right. Honestly.
Yeah.
Jesus then charges the disciples to avoid giving offense. And In verse 10, he says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father." Many people who read this passage believe that Jesus not only alludes to, but even establishes the notion that every person has a guardian angel. When he says, "I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the faces of my Father."
Oh, because he's specifically saying their angels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Possessive, you know?
Right.
So he's saying every person has a guardian angel and that these always have access to God to receive orders relative to the management of their charge. Yeah. So a lot of people are like, yeah, totally. I totally believe in guardian angels. And they can even show you legitimately where it says in the Bible that that might be a thing.
Right.
And that sucks because I hate it.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't make it any more true. Just because somebody says it in the fucking Bible doesn't mean shit to me.
No, I recognize that, but it's comfort for them to be able to do so.
They can point to it.
And I hate that.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so then we get the parable of the lost sheep. And this one wrinkles. I fucking hate it all the way down. Because it's very reminiscent of the prodigal son, which we'll read about in one of the other.
You did not like this at all.
No, it pisses me the fuck off.
Right.
Like, I hate it so much.
Yeah.
But the parable is really aimed at religious leaders who thought sinners were disposable. So Jesus is saying God doesn't write people off. He's always going to go after the missing one.
I take issue with that because he wrote a lot of people off.
Yahweh did. But Jesus is saying Jesus doesn't. And I'm like, well, Jesus is not Yahweh.
Right.
And Yahweh did write a lot of people off.
Yeah.
But that's another one of the changes that Jesus is making. Even though he said he was changing nothing, he's changing everything.
Unless you're a Canaanite woman who was begging Jesus to do something until...
And even that he changed.
Until he changed his mind.
Yep. Yep. So he's not praising the bad behavior of the 99 sheep who didn't get lost. He's not praising the bad behavior of the one sheep who wandered off.
Sure.
He is praising the recovery of every single lost soul.
Got it.
Which kind of comes down to the same. Either way, you're throwing a party.
Right.
And it ain't in my honor.
Yeah.
Even though I stayed back.
Right.
Like, thank you for letting me eat some of the charcuterie, I guess. Like, whatever. And then, like, one of the notes I came across, a lot of scholars are like, whether that explanation feels satisfying is another question.
Sure.
And I'm like, yeah, I can see why. Because it's not.
Right.
I don't love it.
Yeah.
All right. So then we get to verses 15 and 16. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along so that, quote, every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. That quote comes from Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15.
Okay.
One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of crime or offense they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So,
okay.
That's what Jesus was getting at there.
Okay.
Okay.
So he's just reiterating a law from the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And saying it slightly different.
Sure.
Okay.
But he did have quote marks around it to let you know this is
from
part of the law.
Right.
I'm just reminding you of it.
Sure.
Okay. And it's like he sprinkles in pieces of the law,
right,
periodically just to remind you, oh no, totally, this is still Jewish law,
right,
even though I'm bringing up a lot of stuff that isn't,
right, they're throwing in some greatest hits.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. All right, so then we get to verse 18. Truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven.
Yeah, I was a little confused with this.
You were like, what is the binding and the loosing?
Sure.
What? Loosing? Loosing.
Yeah, what's going on here?
What are you binding? What are you loosing?
Right.
I know what a binder is. Like, there's two types of binders I know. Like, if you go to school and you get a trapper keeper to put your notebook paper in, that's a binder. Or, like, if you are trying to calm your tits because maybe you're trans or maybe you're just not wanting to have them, whatever, you can wear a binder.
Oh, by not wanting to have them, you mean tits?
Tits.
Got yeah. it. Okay.
Yeah. I said calm your tits.
But also do your research and be careful with that stuff because it can be
harmful to your back. And yeah. So you should do it with a doctor's guidance.
Right.
And also make sure you check in even with a, not a chiropractor, a spinal specialist.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So anyways, what the fuck is binding and loosing?
Sure.
Right? So this actually was pretty ordinary Jewish language. To bind meant to forbid, prohibit, or declare something not permitted. So I bind you from doing that.
Okay.
This is bound from you.
Got it.
Okay?
Yeah.
To loose meant to permit, release, or allow. Okay? Sure. Jewish rabbis used these terms when interpreting religious law. The context here is church discipline and conflict resolution, suggesting that the community has authority to make decisions about disputes and membership. So he's talking about them congregating and how to do conflict resolution as a group.
Got it.
He's telling
them. Here's how you settle arguments, guys.
Yeah. He's like, keep in mind, make rules and follow through with them. Say what is allowed and what isn't, because whatever rules you make here are how people are going to live. And that will be reflected in the kingdom of heaven.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
So different Christian traditions, though, interpret this differently.
Of course.
Because they're different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many different.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Catholics often connect it to church authority. Which, of course they would. Right.
Yeah.
Protestants often connect it to congregational decision making.
Sure.
Which that makes sense also.
Right.
The original phrase likely meant something closer to the community has authority to make judgments, decisions, and legitimate rulings.
Sure.
So it's just about how they decide as a group what rules to enforce and enact.
You can make up your own club rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those club rules will still apply in heaven.
Yeah. And, so, you know, what the kingdom of heaven is, where that resides at first is amongst you. You know, your community will reflect it.
Sure.
Which I kind of like that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it because I like it for how any community should come together to make rules for itself.
Yeah.
Just like we decided as a community in Minneapolis, for example, fuck ICE. And I fucking love that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Okay. So then we get to verse 20. For where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them.
Yeah.
And we had issues and questions about that.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
That's the whole house church thing and
right.
The small churches and all that.
Yeah. And it gets a little hard to manage what the fuck Christianity is when you're
right.
dividing it that sparsely.
Exactly.
Right.
Modern Christians will use this quote to back up their reasons for prayer meetings, Bible studies, worship services, and as you and I discussed, the house churches.
Right.
So that you can meet as a full congregation on Sunday, but then have these other house churches like other nights of the week or maybe even Sunday night or,
yeah.
you know, we get together on Wednesday for like vacation Bible school, Bible study. And then we have a women's study on the same night as we have a men's study. And then we do a church group. Like you could go to church every night of the week.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's crazy. All right.
Yes.
Sorry. I lost my place. I lost my fucking place. In context, this was actually about dispute resolution and community judgment. So the surrounding verses on either side of it, they concern conflict and discipline. So the original meaning of the church thing, the small church, and where any two or three of you, I'm there,
yeah.
was probably closer to when a community gathers to make a difficult decision, God is present with you in that.
Okay.
So, but I'm like, got whatever.
It. Right.
I don't know. The whole thing bugs me.
Yeah.
I'm like, God is everywhere. He's in all the things.
Right.
Like, God needs to, like, get his shit together, honestly.
I agree.
All right. So then we get forgiveness in the kingdom community and the parable of the unforgiving servant.
Okay.
Do you remember what that was about?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay, so there's this really rich guy, and
he's got the servant.
And he forgives the servant's debt, right? And then that servant has a servant beneath him doesn't forgive.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so verses 21 and 22. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times? And Jesus answered, I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times.
Right. That's 78th time, though.
No, don't do it.
Right out.
Well, here's the thing about that we didn't catch.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny. Peter's question, and of course it was Peter.
Yeah.
He's the goof, right?
Right.
His question about forgiveness was basically like a humble brag. He's like, should I forgive him seven times? Because some rabbis taught that forgiving three times was sufficient.
Mm.
Yeah. So seven would have been really generous.
I see.
Yeah. So Peter was like, so obviously more than three. So I should do, seven's a good number.
Sure.
And I always do seven. I should do seven, right?
Got it.
Yeah.
So he thought it was good.
Yeah. And then
Jesus is like, nah, man.
Yeah. Peter was like trying to impress Jesus, right? Like, look how spiritually mature I am. Seven times. That's a lot of forgiveness, am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Jesus blew right past it. Basically telling Peter, stop counting.
Yeah.
You're dumb.
Right.
You should just give up.
Yeah.
The number itself, though, is a callback to Genesis chapter 4.
Yeah.
After Cain kills Abel, Cain receives protection from the Lord. So in verse 15, but the Lord said to him, anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. And then later on, Cain's descendant Lamech boasts to his wives in verse 23 and 24, I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times.
That's what I was trying to remember when we were reading through it, because I recalled that there was a 7 and a 77.
Yeah.
But I couldn't remember
that's where it came from.
Yeah, that's where
it came from.
Okay.
So this is a message celebrating the escalation of revenge that Jesus is deliberately reversing.
Hmm.
The Genesis story was unlimited vengeance. Always get them back.
Yeah.
Eye for an eye. Go, right?
And now it's unlimited forgiveness.
In Matthew, it's unlimited forgiveness.
Interesting.
But I'm not changing anything, says Jesus. I happen to agree with his message this time.
Sure, sure. But the message is very convoluted.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's very muddy.
It is.
There's not a lot of clarity here for me.
Right.
Because it's like in one hand, he's like, nah, we're still mean. And then the other hand, he's like, nah, we forgive them all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are we doing here?
And you are still all worms.
Right.
Never forget that you are all still worms.
Like, there's so much judgment, but this whole book is not meshing real well for me.
No, it's not for me either.
Yeah.
All right, so then we get to verse 24. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him.
Yeah.
Okay. So 10,000 was the largest commonly used Greek number word.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So that just meant a whole fuck ton.
Right.
Right. Greek 10,000 talents. A talent was worth about 20 years of a day laborer's wages.
Got it.
A massive amount of money. Just ridiculous.
So 10,000 was like a trillionaire.
Basically.
Right.
So Jesus essentially combines the biggest number with the biggest unit. So 10,000 is the biggest. And then a talent, which is also the biggest.
Got it.
So he's basically like saying, this dude was owed $1 trillion, $11 billion.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Like, just unimaginable. The audience would have laughed because the debt is so cartoonishly impossible to repay. Right. And that's the point.
Sure.
How could someone in prison, we asked, even earn money to repay a small debt, much less a big one?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
He couldn't.
Right.
And that, too, was the point of the story.
Okay.
Because you and I asked, like, why is a guy throwing him in jail and saying, you can figure out how to pay me back?
Yeah, right.
Like, that's stupid.
Yeah, it's dumb.
And we thought maybe, I don't know, maybe either this is a bad story or there's a workaround. No, it's a bad story.
Okay.
But it wasn't a bad story because it was the point of the story. The debt in the parable is intentionally ridiculous. It's so impossible that repayment is hopeless, and jailing the debtor is effectively saying, on top of being ruined, you're super ruined.
Got it.
You're mega the most ruined.
Yeah.
The impossibility makes the king's forgiveness that much larger and is that much more comparable to God's forgiveness of our sins.
Ah, okay.
The ridiculously high forgiveness factor.
Right.
So that's where that comes in.
Okay.
And then we had another question. Wait. Servants had servants? What?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they did. The answer is yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The Greek word often translated here as servant covers a really broad range of social positions.
Okay.
These were not minimum wage employees. The concept applied to anyone under another person's authority.
Oh.
So it wasn't necessarily slave. It was actually sometimes servant.
So I'll say it right here that we probably got that wrong quite a bit in the Old Testament.
I'm going to say no, we probably didn't.
We may have gotten it wrong a few times in the Old Testament at the very least.
I'm going to go with, but more often than not, we were right.
Sure.
Because
definitely there are times when they referred to servants that they were slaves.
Yes.
That much I know for
and
sure.
And also, just because they were being paid doesn't mean that they had choice of occupation.
Right.
It might have been a form of indentured servitude, which is still a form of slavery if you are trapped and cannot move of your own volition outside of that hierarchy.
Right.
So I'm going to say slave still works.
Yeah.
But maybe high class slave, better paid, a gilded cage.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Ancient households back then could be super huge, like estates, right?
Okay.
And so a high ranking royal servant might have people to manage the estates, and they might have people to oversee the taxes. They might have people to supervise workers.
Good Lord, they have their own little fiefdoms.
Yeah. They might even control enormous sums of money that passed through their hands to all of these workers.
Got it.
So they were just well-paid slaves.
Sure.
They were fancy slaves.
Right.
The first servant in the parable is important enough to owe the king a fortune, which is notable.
Yeah.
Because who is close enough to the king to even owe that much of a debt to the king?
Right.
But then he turns around and finds someone beneath him who owes a much smaller debt.
Yeah.
So this is a whole chain of obligations, starting with the king, and then it passes down through the senior servant down to the junior servant.
Right.
And this was a perfectly normal setup in that world.
Okay.
Okay. Which, okay, I buy that.
Sure.
Thank you for answering my question.
Well, and that makes sense, because a lot of the things that they are talking about in this book, they're trying to relate to people on the level that they would understand, right?
Exactly.
Like they're speaking to common folk.
The people at the bottom.
They're trying to speak with stories that make sense to them.
Yes, yes. And that's sometimes hard to remember because the story is so ridiculous, even on its own. And then you add to it the story as compared to our time and how we view it, makes it even sillier. Well,
I would wager that most people back then, the way that it was interpreted in those times versus now was dramatically different.
Mm-hmm.
It was more about the overall message and less about the exact words, and this is God's word, and you know, all those things.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know this 100%, but based on what I do know of certain things, I would say that those things came later.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have any like factual basis to say that's because of this, that, and the other, but that just based on the reading and studying that we've done, that feels like it's more likely than other methods.
Well, I think that that's true because each person and their neighbor would have operated the same. They would have held the same beliefs, the same behaviors, sure. the same practices.
Yeah.
That's not true today.
Right.
And so one message for one person is not going to be the same, you know?
Right.
So back then, it would have meant something entirely different, but it would have applied to a whole group who does everything the same.
But and part of what I'm getting at, though, is that today's crowd would not be able to interpret these things on a just reading it from the Bible level,
right?
And understand it at the same way that people back then would have, sure. Right? So just that fact alone, right, mm-hmm. means that they've had to come up with ways to make this relevant to people today, and mm-hmm. by calling it God's word, it allows that relevance to carry through, even though the message has been lost thousands of years ago.
Yes.
The direct message, the message that was written for those people 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's
so all we're saying. Getting like some of the feeling, but not the actual message, but the feeling even at that has been redigested
yeah.
and it spit out real ugly on the other side.
Right, right.
And I don't like it.
No.
And it wasn't that great in the first place.
No.
So then we get to verses 27 and 28. The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go.
Right.
But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. He grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay me back what you owe me, he demanded. So in the Greek, 100 denarii was a denarius.
Oh.
Which was the usual daily wage of a day laborer.
Okay.
But I thought denarius.
Right, oh. Yeah. Yeah, getting into some...
A Song of Fire and Ice
right,
and
yeah,
Game of Thrones territory.
Right, right.
Mother of Dragons and whatnot. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right, so then we move on to forgiveness.
Okay.
And genuine forgiveness from the heart is required of all who have been forgiven. Okay.
Okay.
Do you remember all of that?
Vaguely.
Yeah, it was annoying. Because we were like, what does forgiveness even mean? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Because no,
right.
I don't have to. Get the fuck off me. So the English word forgive comes from the idea of giving up a claim against someone. And the Greek word that's often used in the New Testament literally means things like release, let go, send away, or cancel. Like a debt.
Okay.
In the debt parable, forgiveness literally means cancellation of debt.
Yeah.
And that's why debt language and sin language often overlap constantly in the Bible.
Interesting.
Forgiveness does not necessarily mean to pretend it didn't happen or to trust someone again immediately. It doesn't remove consequences and it doesn't mean reconciling at all costs.
But again, lost in translation, right?
Yes.
Like, I mean, thousands of years have muddled the message, again, could have been something completely different
mm-hmm.
in that time versus now.
Right. Right.
And there's no way to reconcile that.
Only know based on the Greek words
right.
that were used and like how they're used elsewhere in literature, what they probably meant.
Sure. But I know how it's taken today.
Yes.
And the fact that like as I'm sitting here processing this
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking about the fact that this is the book of Matthew, right? And Matthew was a tax collector and we're talking about debts forgiven. And mm-hmm. that's one of the parables. And then we're talking about forgiveness in the same vein.
Yes.
Right. And it's all, it could be very much taken as, like you said, it's not reliant on you actually making amends mentally or anything
right.
like that. It's just a mere statement of this law that exists
in
ancient times.
I'm no longer going to go after you
right.
for retribution. We're not friends again ever.
Right.
But today, you would be expected to shake hands, make up, be friends. That's what forgiveness means today.
Right,
a whole rigmarole that wasn't actually attached to it.
Not necessarily. I'm not saying that it was or wasn't. But like, there's no way. Again, there's no way to reconcile whether it was or wasn't. And we now lean so heavily into that forgiveness, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
idea that
yeah.
it's overtaken much of what Christianity is in some regards, right?
Yeah.
And to take that message to the height that it has gained today from what we're reading seems a bit much, you know,
mm-hmm.
in context, in studying it, and digging into it, it feels like that might be too much.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. That's
yeah.
all I was getting at.
Well, another thing that I find interesting is you've got your anti-Semitic Christians who don't seem to forgive the Jews for murdering their Messiah. Well,
and that's all and part I'm of that like, hypocrisy that I can't really wrap my brain around, you know?
I don't think you guys got the message.
Yeah,
The biggest message he fucking taught. We're not even, like, all the way through it. It's the biggest message he's talking.
Especially if that's what you're if that's what you're claiming, and you seem to claim that quite a bit, right. So like the hypocrisy in religion, Christianity specifically, is one of my biggest problems with that religion, because they don't seem to walk the walk very often,
right?
You know,
and we're speaking in very general terms,
absolutely,
terms,
and there are absolutely good Christians who do walk their walk and do their things the way We have friends who are Christian, right? So I'm just
going. That sounds so funny. We even have Christian friends.
Well, no, but we do, and I would never call them bad people,
right?
Unless they are, you know,
right?
And so, I do know Christians who I believe to be decent, good folk, sure. You know, and that's all I'm saying. Overall. I see a lot of hypocrisy, and especially if you watch the news and all the fucking crimes that happen, especially against children in the church.
Yeah,
it is very filled with hypocrisy.
That and Christian nationalism is disgusting.
It's fucking just terrible. Grotesque. It's terrible.
So according to, if we're to take the Greek use of the word forgive,
sure.
It means relinquishing the right to keep collecting on a debt.
Okay,
that's what forgiveness means.
Got it.
Emotionally, what that might look like is you hurt me, but I'm no longer seeking repayment from you.
Right.
I no longer require retribution or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I'm done being mad at you and holding you. Yeah.
Right.
The relationship might still be damaged and boundaries might still be necessary and trust might still need rebuilding, if at all.
Sure.
But the cycle of vengeance has ended.
Got it.
And that's cool. I can deal with that.
Yeah.
That's a little more livable.
Right.
But Matthew chapter 18 as a whole is obsessed with this debt language. The chapter is less about emotions than obligations. Like, there's a lot of recurring themes. We get lost sheep, debts, forgiveness, accountability, and reconciliation. And so the moral universe of Matthew often works like bookkeeping. We get sin creates debts, forgiveness cancels debts, and judgment settles accounts.
Yeah.
And so this financial metaphor became deeply influential in later Christian theology, which we've talked about.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it originated due to the fact that Matthew was a tax collector,
right?
Basically an accountant, the worst of the worst.
Sure. So, yeah. He saw it through that lens, you know, like,
and yeah, that's how he saw it. And so that's how he called it.
But that, the idea that this was seen through the lens of a tax collector, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not even necessarily written down directly by Matthew,
right?
But by his followers. Again, we're seeing it through a lens of somebody 2,000 years ago who didn't even necessarily write the story down himself.
Right.
Right. And this is the book that we're supposed to start the New Testament with, where we start to understand who and what Jesus is. Right. Right. And somehow this is supposed to convince us of the validity of Jesus and the Jesus story and Christianity and all of it.
And right? We're supposed to be overtaken with the beauty and spirituality and the glory of God is supposed to shine through this.
And we're supposed to connect it directly to the Old Testament. Like, there's so many things that are supposed to happen with this story that just aren't fully happening for me.
Well, I'm so sorry, but I'm still stuck on chapter 17 with the cameo appearances.
Oh, yeah. That was something.
What's that called when, like, you're walking through the mall and suddenly a bunch of people just start singing in unison?
A flash mob. Yeah.
Yeah. This was like a pop-up flash mob.
Yeah.
Of the greatest hits. And that's silly.
Right. I mean, there's been a lot of silly things that just kind of popped up in the Bible.
Yeah.
you know.
To me, that one takes the cake.
There's the talking donkey. There's, you know. There's all kinds of stuff.
Right. And a lot of those can be put down to, like, fables and tales passed down. But this one is supposed to be a little more recent-ish in history. It's still ancient times, but it's... I'm sorry, we're in the AD now, right? And I'm like, no, this is when, like, shit was getting real as far as, like, historicity.
Yeah.
Historicity, whatever that word is. And, like, less reliant on old stories and tales and legends. Like, this is where they're starting to rely on their eyesight, you know, what they can see and what they can prove.
Sure.
And you can tell because they're using psychology to, like, move the masses.
Right.
And then they throw that fucking story in there. Nah, get out of here with that. No, I'm not about it. It's just so silly.
It is.
It's the silliest. It's sillier than anything that popped up in the Old Testament.
Yeah. All right. So if you're listening to this the day that it comes out, it is Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Which means that tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern on our Discord, we will be doing our live. Mm-hmm. And on that live, we'll be going over what chapter?
We will be reading Little Maddie, chapter 19.
Yeah, and you should join us. The link is always in the show notes below. And you can always find how to get to our Discord from our website, which is sacrilegiousdiscourse.com. And we would love to see you there.
We totally would. Don't be a loser. Come on.
Yeah, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.
Hey, wife, I guess that's the end?
But husband, that's just sad.
It doesn't have to be. We are on lots of social media platforms like Twitter. Our handle there is sacrilegious_D.
For D's nuts.
Oh my God. Stop doing that. Anyway, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. There's a link to all of our social media sites at our website.
Ooh, we have a website?
Yeah, it's sacrilegiousdiscourse.com, where you can also find a link to our merch shop.
We have a merch shop?
Yep. We have podcast-themed clothing, mugs, notebooks, and more, as well as an atheist and science-themed products.
Wow, our fans should really go check that out right now.
Definitely. They can get in touch with us by sending an email to sacrilegiousdiscourse@gmail.com. But before they do that, we could really use some help.
Oh yeah? With what?
Well, it's not free running the podcast, and we need some financial support in order to get better equipment, which will free up time so we can concentrate on our podcast and our fans.
Okay, so what should they do?
Head over to patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse and sign up as a contributor on our podcast. Supporters there receive additional bi-weekly episodes that we record just for our Patreon members for as little as $2 a month.
Also, we'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using.
And Apple Podcast reviews help us out tremendously.
Like and subscribe. Leave an Apple review. Join us on Twitter. Support us on Patreon. That's a lot of instructions. Don't forget to say thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.